Hello and welcome to Vox Talks, a series of audio interviews with leading economists from around the world. I'm Viv Davis from CEPR. It's the 11th of March 2010 and I'm at Tilburg University in the Netherlands attending a CEPR workshop organised by Torsten Beck and Xavier Freixas on the theme of pro-cyclicality and financial regulation. I took the opportunity to talk to Torsten about his current research program.
I think I'd like to divide this discussion of my research program in five parts. I would say that all of these components, or my overall research program, is on the one hand building on what I've done before and building on the literature, on the other hand kind of also motivated and informed by the current events and the current crisis. So, for example, one of the big debates that we are currently having is whether the financial liberalization over the 80s and the 90s, the deregulation that then led to financial deepening, has actually increased income inequality. And that's especially an argument that has been used in the case of the U.S., And in some recent work, actually, we found that this is not the case, that the deregulation episode in the 70s and 80s in the U.S. has led to a reduction in income inequality, not to an increase. Of course, that's relative to the overall increase, but it has shaved off 15 or 20% of the overall increase in income inequality. So financial deepening does not necessarily lead to an increase, but actually might lead to a reduction in income inequality and also to a reduction in poverty levels. Now, you might wonder how important is this for a developed country. It might be much more relevant for the debate on finance in developing countries. And one of the follow-up studies that I'm currently working on is on India, where similarly as in the U.S., we have a wide subnational variation in socioeconomic conditions, but also in policies and in reform implementation. And we'd like to use that this variation to explore the relationship between financial deepening and financial broadening and changes in income inequality and changes in poverty, to not only see what effect financial development has on the lives of the poor, but also what kind of channel that is. Is it because there's broader access to financial services, maybe to credit, or is it because the financial sector became more efficient and helped pull more people into the formal economy?
Your second area of research is concerned with the relationship between finance and economic growth. It's a subject that has generated many countervailing viewpoints. What are your observations in this area, and particularly in light of the current crisis?
Where we've kind of established through different methodologies, different data levels, and so on, that finance, that the relationship between finance and growth is not driven by reverse correlation or causality or omitted variable. But of course, the current crisis again sheds doubt on whether, especially in high-income country, a further deepening of the financial system can actually help growth or actually makes finance more fragile and ultimately can lead to more crises. And I think the two observations I want to make here, one is that it seems that especially in many developed countries, the recent deepening and broadening has been more on the side of household credit rather than enterprise credit. And in some recent research, I've shown that it's actually more enterprise credit that helps increase growth rates. It's not necessarily household credit. So further financial deepening, which is more on the household side, might have other benefits, but it doesn't necessarily have growth benefits. Which brings me to another issue, which is we economists, especially economic economists, we've been talking about the financial sector as kind of a facilitating sector, which kind of helps oil the machine of a modern market economy. But it seems that increasingly, especially in policy circles, there's more the view on a financial center. So you see the financial sector as one among many and try to turn it into an export sector. And we have seen this especially in some European countries, especially some smaller European countries. While initially this might have brought some growth benefits in the short term, it has also affected these countries even more heavily in the crisis. And so I'm trying to use this episode to take a kind of motivated by this current crisis to see kind of a broader view of what kind of financial sector does actually help growth. Purely the facilitating view, but also alternatively the financial sector as kind of an export sector in the sense of a comparative advantage.
I think in relation to this, you've also been looking at the role of securitization in the current crisis and whether it's had a beneficial or a detrimental effect. But given that there's not much literature available on this, how did you approach it?
Theory tells us that, or simple accounting actually tells us, that banks being able to securitize loans might, number one, increase lending supply and might also diversify risks. Of course, there are downsides in terms of reduced incentives for banks to properly screen and monitor and over the lifetime of a loan if they can get rid of all the risks through securitization. So again, using data actually for the U.S., so again, exploiting the variation across U.S. states over time, we would like to see whether securitization has had a beneficial or rather detrimental or maybe insignificant effect on financial sector and real sector outcomes.
Your next two areas of research have been very much motivated by the current crisis and in particular by the failure to properly resolve the problem of weak banks. And also, in relation to this, the question of how best to reconcile competition and stability in the banking sector more generally, which is a topic, in fact, that you've looked at in detail in the recent CPR report on bailing out the banks. Perhaps you could outline some of your observations in these areas for us.
What we observed, especially here in Europe, where most countries up to now haven't had any formal bank resolution framework, studying this across countries, we are currently collecting data on how countries around the world have solved weak banks, both reducing credit bank failures, but also in the context of systemic crisis, and see whether we can relate the variation in the methods of resolving weak banks with risk-taking activities of banks. But also with the speed of intervention in a failing bank. Also related to failure resolution is some theoretical work I'm doing on in the context of the European financial systems, where we observe a high degree of cross-border banking. So where the home country supervisor, so the home country where the headquarters of a bank is located, does not necessarily have the incentives to take into account the interests of large parts of a bank's depositor or borrower base because they're located elsewhere outside the authority, outside the market of the home country supervisor, and therefore this might bias the incentives of a home country supervisor to intervene in time into a weak bank. I would like to explore the trade-off between, on the one hand, national supervision, and on the other hand, having a supranational supervisor who would kind of take into account not only home country but also host country interests, but on the other hand, might have less information available out about the bank that it has to supervise.
Your fourth area of research is looking at the relationship between competition and stability in the banking sector. This is a topic that has really gained prominence during the crisis.
This has been a very old debate where some people say a more competitive system undermines the franchise value of banks and therefore lead to more risk-taking. The other side says, more competitive banks provide lower interest rates and therefore borrowers who get lower interest rates also take lower risks. Evidence leading up to the crisis has been that actually more competitive systems are not necessarily more fragile. They might actually be more stable. Many of these empirical results have been might have been driven by the overall period of the Great Moderation or by an overall increase in consolidation during the period leading up to the crisis. So revisiting some of these issues, I think, is very important. And also revisiting these issues in the context of a changing business model that we have observed across banking systems in the world, away from traditional deposit and lending business, more to non-lending business, fee-based business, but also away from deposit funding, more to wholesale funding. So that's another area where I'm looking into the interaction between competition and changes in business models for the individual banks, but also then more on the overall a banking system basis.
Now moving on to what is a relatively new area of research for you, and an area on which you've written several articles for Vox, in fact, is the subject of gender difference in banking. Again, I suspect there may not have been a lot of data available on this, so what was your approach?
There is a literature looking into whether women are better investment managers, investment fund managers, take more conservative or more risk-averse decisions, are better informed, but there has been little debate on whether gender plays a role in the banking, in banking itself. And using very unique data sets for on the bank level, where we have both loan applications and actual loans and loan performance, plus information on the borrower and information on the loan officer. One issue that I'm currently looking into is, or that I've looked into, is the relative performance of female and male loan officers. Are loans that are being screened by and monitored by women, by female loan officers, less or more likely to get into arrears than loans screened and monitored by male loan officers? And what we find is that actually female loan officers seem to be more efficient, even controlling for the fact that the interest rate on riskier loans might be higher. Female loan officers seem to be better in terms of screening based on unobserved, so kind of the smell test, and female loan officers seem to be better in terms of monitoring and following up with borrowers and making sure that they repay. That's of course important in terms of policy implications. You might then think about compensation structures being different for female and male loan officers if they have the performance of these of the gender is different in banking. So that's a quick overview of my research program. I think all of these are pretty policy-relevant questions directly for the supervisory structures, regulatory frameworks, but also would inform the overall debate on how important is our financial systems in the development process for developing country, in the modern market economy and the growth process going forward in the industrialized countries, and what kind of financial system do we actually want? The facilitating role, single European financial system, or more competition among countries for financial sectors?
The policy relevance of these research areas, particularly for the industrialized countries, is self-evident and very clear. Do you think there are lessons or key policy messages emerging from this research that might be particularly relevant for developing countries?
Yes, I think so. I mean, for example, in the finance and growth literature, if we compare household credit and enterprise credit, and again, we found that it's mostly enterprise credit that drives the positive effect of finance on growth, that has, of course, an impact on developing has an implication for developing countries who are starting out to deepen their financial systems. And so, again, it seems that it's more through the enterprise side, not necessarily through trying to give credit to everybody, especially to households, that we might get the growth and enhancing effect of finance. Similarly, and depending on what we find, the role of securitization on financial development. Here we go into study industrial countries, but of course this has implications for developing countries where securitization has not taken off yet, but which of course look very carefully at the experience of industrialized countries to see whether the positive benefits, the growth benefits of securitization might be offset by some kind of stability disadvantages coming from this technique.
Do you look at things like microcredit initiatives in developing countries?
Well, yes. I mean, that is directly related, although I haven't used that word yet. But, for example, in the area of the effect of finance on income inequality and poverty reduction, the big debate is here, should we expand access to credit as much as possible? Or is it rather that through a more efficient financial system that better allocates capital to enterprises that need the most and that deserve the most, that we get a poverty-reducing effect of financial sector development? the evidence on expanding access to credit has been very mixed. I mean, the few studies and the slowly increasing literature on access to credit, which looks carefully through randomized experiments in this, on this issue, has not really shown clearly that there is a positive effect on of access to credit on welfare and on poverty reduction. There is some evidence, as I mentioned earlier, in the case of the U.S. And on the case of Thailand, that making financial systems more efficient helps pull more people into the formal economy or into the formal labor market, and therefore increases the lot of these people, the welfare of these people, and ultimately reduces income inequality. So it might be more an indirect effect of financial liberalization and financial development that helps reduce poverty.
It's interesting. Thank you very much, Torsten. It's been very interesting to talk to you today.
Thank you.